over four decades, Catch One was LA's disco hotspot, where stars, politicians, and folks of all flavors came together to dance the night away. The Catch came to be known as the West Coast Studio 54. Madonna described it as a fat club in a fat neighborhood.
The new documentary, Jewel's Catch One, explores the life of the club's extraordinary owner, Jewel Tice Williams, who fought through homophobia and racism in the 70s to build her club into a legendary institution. Today, Jewel Tice Williams, the grand dame of LA's gay disco scene, joins us to talk about her amazing life as a disco pioneer. Listen as Jewel chats with us about her struggles with addiction, how the AIDS epidemic affected the nightlife scene, how she got into nutrition, and did Madonna really learn how to vogue at her club?
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Right now, you have Feast of Fun in your ears because for the last 13 years, a listener just like you took the time to support this one-of-a-kind, in-depth programming. If you like the show, please make a donation at feastoffun.com/donate. And if you didn't like the show, make a donation anyway to help us improve.
Hello?
Hello, is this Jewel Tice Williams?
Yes, it is.
It's so good to hear your voice. I'm Fausto Fernos.
And I'm Mark Fillion from Feast of Fun. How are you doing today?
Hi, wonderful. Good to hear from you folks.
It's a real honor and a pleasure to be able to talk to the grand dame of Los Angeles gay disco nightlife.
Well, we can say farmer. Put farmer, all of that.
Former? Who took your crown?
Because disco never dies.
Yeah, this is true. No, we had a little party yesterday that was disco-ish and trying to raise funds for the finishing, closing, the music that's in the documentary. So the beat does go on, for sure.
It beat goes on, but sometimes it needs to sit down and catch its breath.
Yeah. You know, even when it was live and thumping, there was always some backlash, you know, disco sucks, and, you know, how it goes, there's always some kind of...
Sure. We live in Chicago, which is was the home of the disco demolition.
Oh, okay.
You do
I
remember
hired
that.
One of your DJs from there, Ronnie Hardy. He played at the Warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in probably the 80s or 90s, mm-hmm. but anyway...
Well, you got into the disco scene pretty early. 1973 was pretty early when disco was really just starting to form.
Oh, yeah. No, we were probably, you know, on the ground level of it here on the West Coast, anyway. For sure. Yeah.
Jewel, can you walk me through what your reaction was when you first started hearing the fusion of salsa and soul, rhythm and blues, and jazz into this new style called disco? Like, what was your reaction to that music when you first heard it?
I liked it because it, you know, covered all of those areas of music, and it was easy to dance to. Here in California, same sexes couldn't dance together, so it was very easy for us not to dance together then. And if the authorities came in, everybody was dancing singularly apart from each other. So that was one of the other, you know, great things about bringing all those genres together.
So a big reason why people dance all by themselves in discos is because it was illegal for same-sex couples to dance together.
Here in California, you know, we were real pleased when it came in, because we had been, you know, being harassed and arrested for even touching the same sex, you know, in a public place. So yeah.
I know in 1972 here in Chicago, like women who wore pants could get arrested because there were cross dressing laws.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it wasn't quite that strenuous here, but we still had some of those laws against women. In fact, when I got the club, which was 1973, there was a law against women being bartenders unless they owned the club. So
Really? That's that seems so amazing. Even in 1973.
Right. We could be waitresses, but we could not be bartenders in the night in the clubs.
So who, when you opened up your club, who was the bartender?
I had taken over the small club, which was underneath the bigger Catch One. That's where I started, and they had already had a bartender in place, and he was this Italian guy, and there was all white folks that were patrons of the club. So he walked out when I walked in and said, introduced myself as being the new owner of the club, and he walked off the job. But there was, it was just a handful of people that came there on a daily basis, and some had been coming there for like 20, 30 years, right?
Mm.
Initially, you were running a clothing boutique, but you decided to get involved in the nightclub business because you felt it was more reliable in terms of income.
Right. But yeah, the downstairs club, which was the Diana, because that's the name that was on it when I first took over, was not, when I came into it, it was not with the idea of making a disco or even having it a predominantly gay place. I had live entertainment, folks like Etta James and a few others of that caliber, plus local musicians and singers performed like six nights a week. So it was more like a cabaret then. And of course, everybody was welcome. So when people knew that I owned the club, then more and more gays and lesbians would come to it. But it didn't. We had gone to straight clubs and heard the same people, you know. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like it was a big deal to have gays and lesbians with heteros and the cabaret types.
Etta James was a very well-established artist at the time, so I can imagine it must have caused quite a commotion to see her inside your club. I can imagine that people were like asking her to sing at last or something's got a hold on me. She must have been flattered, but at the same time probably tired of singing that song by then.
Right. I think she did do At Last, if I remember correctly, in that. But she wasn't booked. She was just coming by to check it out, stayed. And I think she did sing a song or two. And because she had just gotten released from being incarcerated for a while. So it wasn't, I don't know if 1973 was before or after any of those songs. It's been a long time ago.
And so walk me through what happened when you started this nightclub and it evolved into this gay black disco venue that for a lot of people in the 1970s, going to was an act of defiance.
I think it was just a kind of a haven for folks here. I don't think we could consider it a political statement. Folks needed a place to go. And in the early days of the Catch One, this is when we opened it upstairs and declared it a dance place, named it Catch One, which was a term that guys would use for picking up other guys. And so we just put that title on it. So it was obvious that it was to those that were in the know that this was a place where you could go and dance, have a good time, and there would be lots and lots of guys here because it was a big place.
And so Catch One was a terminology like you caught yourself a man.
There you go, yeah. Or they would, say to each other, I'm going out catching, you know, which means that they were going to go out and pick up.
Caught yourself a man.
You know, one, two, three. See, this was in the early stages of the sexual revolution, too, and it was not about being monogamous with most of these folks, even in one night or one day or whatever, you know, multiple encounters. So catching was a big part of a lot of these gay guys' lives.
If you go out to not a lot of clubs these days, people just don't dance like they used to. I mean, the idea of having a giant regular venue where people were dancing to music seems more an anomaly today than it does. Why do you think that's changing so much?
Well, I think the acceptance by the broader community and seeing Grey's Anatomy and other movies, not only Brokeback Mountain or whatever that movie was called, but homosexual behavior portrayed in the mainstream media has opened it up to a point where there's not as much homophobia, and consequently these kids, who a lot of them identify as being polysexual, don't have any reason to be in the closet.
So instead of dancing in the clubs, they're dancing in the sheets.
Pretty much, because they don't dance. They really don't dance in the clubs that tough, you know, which is one of the reasons why I sold it and moved on. They would come and everybody would be on their cell phone. You know, that was the light show. You know, you didn't have to have disco lights and disco balls and that unless you wanted to or had them already, because you could see the flashing of their cell phones. And then obesity is an epidemic, and kids don't exercise even like they did before. You know, the guys that came in here during the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they were at the gym when they weren't in here or at work or whatever, and prided themselves on dressing nice. You know, it wasn't none of the sagging stuff. They had silk shirts on, and the best that they could afford was what they came out in. Today, they don't, you know, what they're on the phone texting, doing the social media, reporting to whomever they is on Instagram or whatever. Oh, this place sucks, so this place is happening. Come on by, or where are you? Okay, well, I'll come there. Why don't, you know, go on Steve for Steve or Adam for Adam or whatever, and they will, you know, I'm at this club, but, you know, it sucks, so why don't we meet at my place or at this park or whatever, you know?
Well, you know, you mentioned that, you know, people back in the day, because when I watch old things from like Soul Train or things from the 70s, it's like you see all these people and they're all super lean and they're dancing and they're having a good time. And you yourself are very interested in nutrition. You went back and got a master's of science degree in Oriental medicine. And you have a program as a reach out to communities of color. To help them with nutrition, the Village Healthcare Foundation.
Yeah, you know, as far as what I do now and what I did then since 2001 was have a clinic. It's based on traditional Chinese medicine, so we're talking acupuncture, herbs, and that sort of thing. My specialty is, in addition to internal medicine, is nutrition, weight loss. Helping people that want to get off of medications be able to do that in a holistic way. Of course, working along with their medical doctors to, okay that it's fine with what they're doing holistically for themselves.
So in the early 80s, you're running this nightclub, all these. It's a it's a liberation for a lot of men to come there and be able to be sexually free with each other. And then the HIV and AIDS crisis of the mid 80s and early 90s hits. Can you walk me through what that experience was like for you as a friend and as somebody who was running a venue and as a gay woman yourself?
It was tough, to say the least. I had opened a Catch One in Houston, Texas, also in 1981, and my sister was managing the Catch out here, and I would commute back and forth at least once every week or two. I would come and spend some time in at the LA club, and then back to Houston. And the first I heard of it, even though it was not identified as such, was one of the drag queens that was the host of a show that I had, because the drag shows and the pageants are really big in the South. So I had drag shows practically every night there. And one of the hostesses went to the hospital. It was over, my day off, and someone told me, that April's in the hospital. I said, oh, really? Okay. I'll see if I can give her a call or go by and see her. And before I could even get the information to get by and see her, she was deceased. And they said, oh, she had pneumonia. Okay. Mm. But it was very quick. Like performing maybe on a Thursday to being deceased within a week or two of that. And so then several other people came down sick. And several other people died. And some survived it, this pneumonia thing that they had. And some didn't. So then, anyway, I knew I had to get back to LA and home, and I was hearing that one or two people were becoming ill out here.
Did you have friends and family that were concerned for your well-being because they didn't understand the disease at the time? They were worried that you might get infected yourself?
No, not that they mentioned to me. I was pretty estranged from my family, except for my sister here. And then when I came back to L.A. from Houston full-time, then my younger sister, who was really the only one in my family that was close to me throughout my being introduced to the lesbian lifestyle and living it, she was the only one that would pretty much come around. But then as my other brothers and sisters found out, most of them rallied to my defense and actually helped me to open the club in Houston while my younger sister was running the club out here in L.A. Them and their wives, our husbands were really, really, okay with that. And if they had some feelings about or worry about my health, my younger sister would have told me. So she was real clear that I wouldn't get it. And plus, I've always been, in my adult life anyway, health conscious. So I felt that, if I got it, then it wouldn't be too many people left on the plane in LA, because of the way that I take care of my body and do supplements.
At the time period, a lot of gay bathhouses, the gay bars and discotheques were under pressure to close. They felt
yeah, they
that,
were.
Uh-huh. Was Jewel's Catch One under the same pressure?
No. We had the bathhouse scene was very, very big here in L.A. too. And there were several really, really famous and popular ones. So, But they stuck around for years and years after the epidemic was identified and known. And even then, I think it might be a matter of not that people were being afraid to go to the bathhouses. It's just that folks had died that used to go there.
And, so there were less customers for these type of businesses to survive.
Right. Well, I think that was one of the reasons why they closed. I was going to say some of the folks that owned them also became infected in that with the disease.
So. Sure. And so as a community, a lot of people started reacting, because we get asked, we do a cooking show too, and people ask us, why are so many LGBT people vegan? Or very, as a community, we are very interested in restricted diets or healthy eating or looking at our health and fitness in very intense ways that I think non-LGBT people are. And I always tell people it's like maybe it's our heritage of our pain and suffering, not just the HIV and AIDS crisis, but the fact that we're sort of misfits and we're sort of outcasts in our own communities. And so we start looking at everything. We don't take everything for granted. And we look at our diets in that same way. What would you think? Why are so many LGBT people interested in restricted diets like being a vegan?
Well, the G's. I'll start with the G's, but the L's are generally overweight and not caring or concerned about their physical.
You mean the lesbians?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. The lesbians are thick and juicy.
Especially the ones that are in the masculine role. tend to let themselves go, gameway, not really care about, you know, that. This is my take on it.
Well, I think there is actually like scientific evidence from this, from some organizations have done a study, and lesbians are typically overweight.
Yeah.
More so than the general female population.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And with the guys, they've always been body conscious and wanted to be body beautiful before age, before anything else. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, shoot, yeah, the bodybuilding magazines were sponsored by gay men, and
that's
the major,
all I'm saying.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But there's also too the bears have kind of become a thing since, you know, the what is it, the mid '90s.
The what?
The bears, the gay guys that call themselves the bears, the bigger guys.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar, but that is is happening with the younger people.
I was looking at an older gay newspaper from the '80s, and they had a group for overweight gay men, and believe it or not, they called it the Elephants.
Oh wow!
It was a happy, smiling elephant, and so I don't know. And so now, you know, because we do have an obesity epidemic here in the United States, and so we have to be accepting of where people are at. And so the bears just said, "Hey, you know, we're bigger guys, and you know, I don't want to be called an elephant. I don't want to be called a whale, but you know, a bear is good."
Right, but I think if you would question those bears, it was a matter of it's too hard for me to try to be this, and then it could have been some genetic issue too with them. Mm. But it's a way of kind of giving up or giving in to having to work on not eating everything and anything that you want, and using food kind of as your pacifier. And so it's just like what I think it's across the board here in the States now. You know, they've glamorized the big girls and that. So the desire to be slim and trim or even average size, you know, is kind of minimized with the fact that they now have, you know, models and reps that are big.
Well, do you have any advice out there? Because, like, I myself, I'm one of those people, if it's in the house, I eat it.
It's going in his mouth. If it's in the house, it's in his mouth.
He's just like, why do you have to eat all the cookies? And I say, because they're there. What, you know, he's like...
yeah, well, you're talking about a recovering big girl. I was never obese, but I was, I've been as much as, like, 50 pounds overweight. Mm. And now at 78, I weigh... 40 pounds or more less than what I did when I graduated from high school 60 years ago. So I know about these things. Personal experience. Do not bring into the house anything that you don't want to eat. You know, like if I get some cookies and it only comes in a big size, my favorite cookie comes in one single pack, one cookie, and I don't start eating it until I get home and in my jammies. So the inclination to run back out and get another one is taken away. Okay. Just don't bring it in the house. And I will go and get a big bag of popcorn if that's the only way that it comes, and I'll eat what I want usually in the parking lot of the store, and when I leave I'll give it and maybe a couple of bucks to some homeless person on the street, whatever's left, and I don't bring it with me because I'm not going to stop. You know, I have the junkie mentality. I'm not going to stop
so
eating.
So it's the parking lot diet.
That's it. Or near homeless people diet.
You eat what you can, and then you give to the people hanging outside the rest.
That's right. Right. Before starting on yours, if you can. With the popcorn, I just eat it out, roll up the bag, and pass it out the window with a couple of bucks at somebody that's at the corner begging.
Regardless of the food that you eat, we all can agree that we don't eat enough vegetables. And it makes me a little bit sad that vegans and vegetarians that I personally know eat a lot of junk food, pizza and potato chips. What up
well,
with that?
Because they don't know. I have been vegan for about 28, almost 30 years, just to round it off. Mm. And my baby bug, you heard what I had for breakfast already. Mm. But and then for lunch or dinner, you know, I'll eat nuts or some fruit or whatever in between. And then lunch, I have salad and beans and rice or something like that. And then dinner, all kinds of vegetables. Like every day, I try to... No, don't do that. Okay. Sorry.
It's all right.
You know, the Queen of England, she has fish and vegetables for dinner, but she also has a gin martini.
Well, I'm 31 years sober, too, so I've eliminated that. I had to.
Yeah, that's another eliminate thing too. Is like if you want to have keep your wits about you as the years go on, cutting out alcohol is a really good way to do that.
I totally agree. I was a late bloomer, you know, so it wasn't until I was in my late 30s, early 40s that I developed a problem with drinking and drugs. So. I only lasted a little while because it didn't suit me at all.
Mm. You were doing lines of cocaine off of somebody's
and
back.
Smoking it too. Yeah, we had what we call freebasing. Mm. You know, where you smoked it actually from a little glass pipe too, and I was snorting it at first, but then. I had a sinus problem, I always did have, so I had to stop that, and somebody introduced me to smoking it, so...
It's a quicker rush, too. Well, you know, it's hard...
It clears the sinuses.
It's hard to do, you know, to run a club and to have a problem with substances is a difficult thing to do.
Right. Well, I dealt with it in the documentary, and I hope you guys get a chance to see it, but, you know, I had to come to grips with it's either me or the club if I can't stop. And ironically, I stopped suddenly one night, you know, well, I had periods of stopping over the 7 years that I used where I would stop for months, sometimes a year or whatever. But I would always go back. So I had processed the fact that I really wanted to stop, and I didn't want anything to get in the way of that. So I had scheduled myself up to 10 bar that day. And from happy hour, I went to my first meeting that morning, first AA meeting that morning. And it was like, wow, for the first time, I felt like I belonged someplace, really belonged someplace. And I'm 48 years old by then. But it kind of fit, the message fit for me. Came out. Tended bar. I did get some non-alcoholic wine and some non-alcoholic beer. Those were the beverages that I consumed.
Speaking of which, let's talk about Rick James. he used to hang out at your club.
He was there some. Yeah, he wasn't really a hangout. In fact, there was a lot of African-American folks that... would come in periodically and try to be incognito because of the acceptance in the black community of homosexuality as nil to none. Mm-hmm.
So are a lot of entertainers coming to your club sort of as market research, or are they just to get a sense of the community?
No, they came because they had heard about it. And they would come in, but they were also afraid of being outed, you know, the black
entertainers. What could possibly Rick James be outed for?
Oh, you'd be surprised at how naive the masses of African American people were about anything. I had never look, my parents, for instance, you know, they never talked. We never heard them talk about sex. We never knew that they did it, except when another kid would pop up. And then we had to kind of put that together ourselves. We never knew, you know, I was still checking out the stork thing until I was about 12 or 13. But because of the church, the Southern Baptist church thing, you didn't discuss sex, you didn't. And for sure, homosexuality was an abomination, and Sodom and Gomorrah, and you go straight to hell, and steering people into believing that. And they didn't want to know or touch or do anything with anybody that they thought might be. For me, I thought that the only gays were the very effeminate ones. Had no idea about guys and husbands and stuff like that. And with women, it was and with these were the black guys with the processed hair and pompadours, you know, and switching and doing all of that. It was only two or three of them in the town, and they all hung the two or three of them hung together, and I thought that was it. And then with the women, it was ones that did wear pants, despite the fact that we couldn't go to school and unless we had dresses on. With these, there's a couple of black girls that I knew. They just didn't go to school then, you know, and their parents allowed them not to go. But what I knew was that there was these white chicks with the duck tails in the back and flat tops on the top, and they usually wore white shirts, and they would have them rolled up and a pack of cigarettes stuck in on the side of it, and they had on jeans and that. So I knew, as the word was funny, I knew they were funny. Okay, but I had no idea until I met my first lover at 25 or 6. And I was telling her the same story. She said, "Well, who do you think their counterparts were?" I said, "I never thought about that." She said, "Well, the chances are they had very effeminate women that were their lovers." Oh, okay.
And back in the day, did you identify more as a stone cold butch or a lipstick lesbian?
Oh no! I've never been a lipstick lesbian. I had a younger brother, like a year and a half younger than I, and my brother that was next to me was about a year and a half older than I was, and plus I was athletically inclined, and I could do. Well, they would get me to go out and win their marbles back if they lost them. "Jewel, would you go down there?" You know, I lost my cat eyes to Johnny down the street down there. "Would you go play him for me?" Out the door, I had business, you know. And
you beat up these kids for
no,
marbles?
No, you play marbles. Oh. It's a game. You have to win them back.
Right. Yeah.
Kids don't play marbles anymore.
I didn't fight. I did what I've named sell wolf tickets. I would threaten really, really strongly. So, you know, like if you mess with me, you know, be prepared to go in, you know, those kinds of threats. But, sometimes when my brothers were, after I got a little bit older, like in my teens, when my brothers weren't there, I'd sneak into their closet and put on one of their sports jackets or whatever, but I could play. And then when I graduated from high school, I came up from San Diego to LA to go to UCLA. I was there for a year and didn't have money to pay anything, so I went back to San Diego, got a job in Parks and Recreation, and this the guy that I was working with, usually the guys did the sports and the women did the crafts, right? He hated sports. I love sports. He loved crafts. So we just did a switch, you know, and so I coached the football teams, the basketball teams, the baseball teams, and he made the macrame and played with the dolls, I guess. I don't know what else they did.
Let's talk about Sylvester, the coquette who rose to fame with her hit song, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real.
Yeah, that's my favorite, and it's in the movie, and he played at the catch a couple of times, too. Three times, I think, total. Yeah.
It's a shame that Sylvester was taken from us at such an early age, because,
oh,
you know,
I'm telling you, he would love it now. He would have been much more famous, I think, than RuPaul at this point in time, you know.
Well, she was just an extraordinary, musician.
Right. The first time they played at the Catch, they came with a live band, and he was just getting started then. And that was some, you know, we didn't have all the filming and all that stuff that came later, but I wish I could have, you know, if I could go back in time, that's what I would want, to have filmed that performance.
I don't quite understand why there's floating around on the internet music videos of Sylvester performing Mighty Real. I guess they aired these at movie theaters or on television, but it's she's in full drag. She's wearing full makeup and women's clothing and pulling out fans and walking down staircases and stuff. What were these music videos used for at the time period?
I don't know that that's him.
Oh, it's her. Yeah.
Oh, you're
it's
sure?
Sylvester. Okay. Absolutely. Unmistakable.
Putting on a show, for sure.
And, you know, like, I know that, like, when HBO and cable television was early, they would ask these artists to release music videos so they could play them in to fill in the gaps when the movies, you know, so, like, if a movie is an hour and 45 minutes long, they could play music, 15 minutes of music videos until the next film started.
I'm not familiar at all, but I do have a... one of my DJs around, and he plays a lot of music.
But you guys didn't play any, like, videos at the club at all.
Yeah, we did.
You did.
But it was later. It was much later.
But that's
later.
In the late 80s. And so then Madonna.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I could be wrong. I'm willing to accept what you say is too, because I didn't. There was a period of time when I was doing more drugging and drinking and spending less time at the club. And
atta
there
girl.
Might have been, but the only thing that I was able to get from folks when I sent it out, and I have a connection with his sister too, so
yeah.
I'm gonna look into to that part.
Now, this is a hotly contested piece of history that I'd like for you to weigh in on. So Madonna introduced the in the film Dick Tracy, she mm-hmm. had in the soundtrack the song Vogue that it sort of mainstreamed this ballroom style dancing that a lot of the queens were doing at the time period. And there's a lot of arguments of where Madonna learned how to Vogue. And some of the materials with this documentary claim that Madonna learned to dance at your club, how to Vogue at your club.
I don't know that anybody knows that but Madonna about where
she won't
started.
Answer the question.
Yeah.
She did dance
here. She was here a lot. In fact, she came by, she and Warren Beatty came by in their Dick Tracy outfits. He had on the yellow suit, and I forget what she had on, but they were here.
Oh, so like to promote the movie or while they were filming the movie?
I don't know why they did it.
Okay.
Because even when I wasn't drinking or using, I didn't ever go to any of the celebrities and say, hey, I'm Jewel, I'm the owner, and this and that. I was always background, probably someplace tending bar in a bathroom, clean up the toilets, or collecting IDs, or being a cashier for the moment, or whatever. But I was never into that. you know, so consequently, there's, except for a couple of celebrities that ask me to take pictures with them, then I don't have them, you know.
Well, over the years,
the reason. I think that might have contributed to a lot of them coming here to know that they could be incognito and wouldn't be, asked to do autographs or whatever. They could just come in and party like anybody else.
Over the years, you guys booked a lot of talent as well.
We did, yes.
And who was the most difficult or the most demanding artist of the time?
I don't know. None of them were.
Because I know Aretha Franklin, she won't go on stage unless there's a suitcase of money waiting for her. Like she has to see the cash. I mean, I don't know if that's true anymore, but when times were tough for her, when she was doing those Pizza Hut ads, that's the rumor that I heard, that she needed to have a suitcase of cash because she did not trust checks.
Well, if you get screwed over by one promoter, you're like, that's it.
Yeah, she's she doesn't fly. Never did. So she has her issues around things. So, and I can understand it after you've been, you know, hit a few times with folks not paying or the checks bouncing or whatever. And then she might have needed some ready cash too. You know.
And now you have a lot of these reality TV stars, and they're being booked onto the clubs in ways that these big name musicians used to be.
I know. I refuse, though. I'm glad I caught in and tail end of that, where I would have to, whatever. But
you hear me, Valentina?
I wasn't going to pay $3,000, you know, because number one, I'm not into those reality show things, and I think. It's a shame that a bunch of talentless people are zillionaires now and with millions of followers and that for nothing. But, you know,
it's but
being vulgar most often.
What was you closed the disco and the last event there was called The Last Dance. What was what was that evening like for you?
It was fun in a way, and then in some ways I think that I didn't think that it was the end ever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, my head knew that it was the end, but my heart wasn't ending then. You know, so it didn't catch up with me about the finality of it all until later. I had fun that night.
And the last song you guys played, I would assume, would be Donna Summer's Last Dance.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
And have you been back to the club since?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just there a few days ago. People want to see it. And the new owners are gracious. They changed a lot of things. It's really, really nice. And they kept a lot of the stuff, too. Mm. So the link. Of the cats is still there, just kind of modernized, fixed up, but they open it up, they tore down walls. It's huge upstairs, you know, enough to hold 2,000 or 3,000 people. And then they have several rooms downstairs, too, that they use for multiple event spaces. So.
It's really incredible that your extraordinary life made it into this film, Jewels Catch One, which is going to be showing here in Chicago on Saturday, August the 19th at the Reva and David Logan Center for the Performing Arts. Seeing your life in this documentary film, is there anything that you feel like didn't make it that you would like to have made it? Because I know that you guys had like a 3-hour cut you guys had to trim down.
Oh, right. No, we had 42 years and to put that in, to 84 minutes, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was left on the floor. So I think that, that Fitz did a good job of managing with the time that was had. But there's lots and lots of stuff, okay?
It's amazing how many, like, celebrities you have involved in the project, too. Interviews with Sharon Stone, Evelyn Champagne King.
Sandra Bernhard.
Yeah. Jennifer Lewis, Thelma Houston, and even Maxine Waters.
Reclaiming my time.
Who's that?
Representative Maxine Waters, who's kind of, she's very famous on the internet right now for her Reclaiming My Time. Oh, yes. The kids are all in love with her because she told the Secretary of Treasury, I'm reclaiming my time, because he kept trying to, you know, belittle her or talk down to her. And she's just like, I'm in charge here.
Right. Yeah, I call her. We're friends, as you'll see in the movies. I mean, legitimate friends. She's the only celebrity type person that, and not like we're bosom buddies and hang out and go here and there. But whenever we see each other, like if she's speaking at a fair or anything, it can be big, it can be little. Mm-hmm. I show up, there's Miss Jewel Williams over there. She's from the Catch One. And she and I did the AIDS thing. I was able to get funding because of her. And, you know, she just does a shout out everywhere. And anytime, you know, she's asked to do something in regards to me, then she's going to show up, you know.
Well, she's super hot right now on the internet.
Yeah, I heard, and the kids love her, and when before all of this censorship and news was taken over by the corporate situation, she used to be on local news here every Saturday at some protest or some march or something. You know, and she does not mince her words in that. So I nicknamed her. She doesn't know she has that nickname, but I nicknamed her Mad Max. You know, I could understand the kids loving her because she would tell it like it is and would not care where and whom it, and whose ears it. And, you know, since we have all of the CBS and all that, and they all get the same footage and all that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's no, you know, Donald Trump talks about fake news, but that's all that there is now, period. Mm-hmm. You know,
misinformation is really at the core of it all. And I think actually social media, there's so much money being poured onto these forums and social media platforms to get us fighting amongst ourselves and to making it seem like there's two sides to this whole like Nazi protest. And I was just like, when did Americans become, you know, aren't we the ones who hunt down Nazis and kill them, not the other way around?
Right. Wow. Yeah,
it's madness.
Well, it's, you know, this was a platform that Donald Trump ran on, and it goes back. You know, there's nothing new. He used the formula. I read this fiction book for when I was in the sixth grade of California politics, and the guy that was losing came up with this formula, fear plus hate equals power. And Donald Trump ran it just like this guy did, you know, from the 40s, that what he had written about. You know, the book was called The Ninth Wave. And he ran that kind of campaign. It made people afraid. You know, these Mexicans are all rapists and that, and then the Muslims are this, and you white people don't have any power now, and you need to try to get it back, and we'll make America great again. What does that mean? What does that translate as going back to, you know, the way it was, back to slavery, which we never left? And if you haven't seen the movie 13, I mean the documentary 13, you see it, and you can see where the continuation of slavery has gone on.
Jim Crow laws, segregation.
Prison system.
Mm-hmm.
Jewel, you've seen so much, and you've survived so many crises. What advice can you give to young people who are listening to the show right now about the current crisis with fascists, racists, Nazis, and the Republican Trump administration?
The number one thing is fear, not to be fearful, because that usually freezes one of the definitions in the 12-step program for fear, the acronym FEAR, is fuck everything and run. And we don't want to do that. We want to take a stand and to organize and take a proactive way of organizing. I love Mother Teresa's attitude when they ask her to march against the Vietnam War. And she said, no. She said, but when you put together a march for peace, I will be in the front leading that, if you want.
Isn't a march against war a march for peace?
No, it's giving power to the war, though. It's just like, you know, what's been happening with all this stuff that with Trump, for instance, and all it's been doing is just giving him more and more power. Is it step out and do anything and say anything now? You know, and who loves him? Who loves you, baby? Nobody that I know.
So the most important thing we can do is to march for peace and not give power to the fascists.
There you go. No, yeah, and we're going to have to move in that direction, because the when you go against, then you have clashes like that. Not putting the onus of the what happened in Virginia on those that opposed. But if you put that energy into wanting peace or wanting, you know, Bernie Sanders to be president, or even I looked at Al Gore's new film on climate change, you know, bring him in. If you just think if the politics of that election, where Al Gore was had won. And then it ended up at the Supreme Court, where he didn't win. Just think how different we would be today if we had taken a stance that, oh no, we don't do this Supreme Court stuff. You know, we're a democracy. You know, let's go back and you know, if enough people, it takes volumes of folks to do this, but if enough people had protested, but instead we had a bloodless coup. You know, in walks George W. And here we are, and we're not only with 4 years, but we're stuck with 8 years of him. Where we could have had 8 years maybe of Gore, who is for climate change, for peaceful coexistence, and all the things that we have to deal with today. Represented by Trump. He didn't come out of a vacuum. Trump, the reason why these people come out now is because they know that they can. And they never went any place with George Bush.
Mm-hmm. They were hiding there all along.
Oh, yeah. No, the closet's opened.
Like cockroaches underneath the stone.
Right. You know, and the abuse that President Obama had to put up with while he was, it would be unheard of. It would be, the folks would be locked up if a representative in there shouts out, liar, while you're giving the State of the Union or whatever speech it was that he was given to. Mm-hmm. Along with that, how is it possible that somebody can fly into the White House grounds on a homemade bicycle or whatever, however they, you know, and the beat just goes on and on and on. And then folks, you know, want to blame him for everything. You know, they listen to all this crap and he's, well, no, maybe he wasn't good. Well, no, he wasn't. He's a dude that came from 2 years in the Senate. That's his only national exposure and only connection was national politics. No lobbyists, no connections at all. And here he is, president. So do you think that he's going to have much power to do anything? I don't think so. One lady accused me of dealing the race card when I had this conversation with her. I said, no, it's no race card. You think they're going to let one lone black man ride in on a white horse and take over the country and actually run it like he has proposed to do?
Mm.
You know, being good and right and honorable, concerned about people? No. Not with what started with the death of John F. Kennedy and old man Bush being in the head of the CIA in Dallas. And then I'm not going to. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Jewel, I want to thank you so much for your service. Your service in creating this amazing institution. Your service in people of need through the AIDS crisis. And your service as a person who continues to be an advocate for change and equality.
Thank you so much for inviting me to do this, too. I really appreciate it.
Of course. I'm looking forward to seeing your film. And you can catch that at the Black Alphabet Film Festival.
Right.
Thank you so much, Jewel.
Enjoy.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Jewel Theis-Williams lives in Los Angeles, California.
Jewel's Catch One, the amazing documentary film on the life and career of our guest, Jewel Theis-Williams, plays here in Chicago this Saturday, August 19th at the Black Alphabet Film Festival at the Riva and David Logan Center for the Performing Arts. The screening is at 1 p.m., we urge you to catch this extraordinary film.
I want to remind folks that we can't do this podcast without your support. And the best way to support this podcast is to become a Plus member. And you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of wonderful, extraordinary people like you. We wouldn't be able to talk to Jewel Theis-Williams if it wasn't for you.
You can also make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate or visit our store at feastoffun.com/store and get yourself a fantastic t-shirt.
I want to thank you guys so much for listening to today's show. I'm Fausto Fornos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everybody.